Welcome to Hunters and Unicorns. Today we welcome Josh Rayner. Josh is currently the VP EMEA at Wiz. In this episode, we go through the beginnings where he started as a legacy rep at BMC, was part of the reverse takeover by Blade Logic, before transitioning into AppDynamics, Zscaler, and right to the present moment. In this fascinating episode, we talk about how he's been able to nurture talent from diverse backgrounds to create one of the most prolific and high-performing teams across the entire globe. This is his playbook. Welcome to Hunters and Unicorns. I'm Simon Kutis and I'm joined by my co-host Ollie Kune.
Welcome back to the show, everyone.
And it's an absolute pleasure to be joined by Josh Rayner. Josh, welcome to the show.
I couldn't be happier to be here. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Josh.
By way of an introduction, Josh, you are the new VP EMEA at Wiz. And just to call out the obvious here, Josh, I think the very first thing that we want to go after is the fact that you are, in fact, American and you are running EMEA. Tell us a little bit about that.
I was going to say, if you didn't know, I'm going to start talking and then very quickly you're going to realize I am American.
That's not AI.
It's not AI driven. We're here. No, it's honestly a blessing and honor to be here and be selected to go run VP of EMEA at Wiz. It is an unbelievable company. What they've done, how fast they've grown, the numbers speak for themselves in terms of that. But one of the big things about it is, the four founders of Wiz, they've done this before. This is the second company that they've gone through, but they go back to 2001. Like, they've been together for their entire term. And then you take a look at me joining Wiz. It's the fourth company that I've done with Dolly, that I've done with Mike. And, 17 years later, you always have those good relationships. And I remember vividly when I was talking to Mike in particular, he said, when you ran the UK and Ireland, and I was running the Northeast, we had zero conflicts. Our team worked well together. We had international across the pond collaboration, and we closed some of the biggest financial services institutions, G2K, and it was great. And he just said, imagine if we could do that here, and we just have no conflicts across EMEA, and we have a playbook company. We all talk, we all know what we're doing, and collaborate. So all the leaders in the US, all the accounts in the US, Now you've learned the UK and Ireland. You spent some time in Middle East and Africa. Now I have the journey to go figure out, I have to go figure out the rest of Europe. So that's a challenge for me it's exciting to go could do that aspect of it. But we're going to do that the right way. We're going to collaborate and we're going to do it together. So yes, it's an honor as an American. I'm going to need my help from my European colleagues along the way. I remember when I first started in the UKI, there was a whiteboard that said the things that the Americans said because they just didn't understand some of the terminologies. But now I know proper. This is a proper interview here in the UK. Yeah. So I'm all in. I'm excited.
Amazing. To be honest with you, I think that the whole kind of US, EMEA, Europe disconnect, it's an important topic that we're going to go after and really explore, because I think this is something that we see time and time again, the disconnect of that. But you've got such an interesting start to your journey, and I actually want to talk a little bit about your first exposure to the playbook, because you were actually part of BMC when they acquired Blade Logic. So you were on the receiving end of the reverse takeover that we've obviously spoken so much about in the show. But just tell us, take us back to that moment.
But to give, just before you answer, Jen, give some context to the audience, it was 2000 that you joined BMC, right?
Yeah, I joined in January of 2001.
So it's 8 years prior to that.
About six, seven years. And then this whirlwind of David Acharya, John McMahon, Paul McGrath, Scott Davis, Andy Byron, they came in like a freight train. And so BMC at the time was about a $2 billion software company, a lot of mainframe, a lot of distributed monitoring tools. But they had acquired, Remedy, and they had acquired a lot of other automation tools, and they were trying to go after this cloud. They were trying to build this business service management market. But traditionally speaking, there was a lot of people that were very comfortable in the job. So this crew comes in and it just hit us by storm. And I still remember they gathered everyone in the Chicago office and they took us aside and they were trying to explain to us why they beat Opsware. and because that's back when John McMahon was battling Cranny, and there was all the
Beautiful story, back and forth.
And I remember going in, and they were answering questions, and it was kind of combative to a certain degree. Like, Opsware is not that great, and we're better, and there wasn't really a lot of context. But what they were really doing, and they were just trying to see like who was going to lean in, like who was asking questions, who wanted to really find out why. And I remember I just raised my hand and I said, "We've been here for about 20 minutes, and you haven't really given us an actual data point of why you beat Opsware. So are you going to get to that topic?" And then Andy Byron pulled me out, and is with McGrath and Davis. And he sat down. He's like, "All we're trying to do is find the independent thinkers. We're trying to find the people that want to question and do that aspect of it here. Because we don't want the legacy people that are just wrapping and rolling contracts or doing growth-based deals. We want people that want to go question and build, because we're going to go take this cloud market, and we have to have people that are talented to go do that." The other aspect about it that I didn't fully appreciate at the time, so I always made my number. It was a great rep. Some people would say I was a bit of a diva, and Dolly may be one of those people that will say that comment. But I was just a neurotic person. I never had enough supporters. The business case was never strong enough. I was always in my customers. But my boss lived in Minnesota at the time, and he had never been in my business. And in this position I was in currently, I'd been there for 2 years. So imagine working at an organization where you basically just roll up a forecast, but your boss is never in your business developing the deals. So they immediately jump in, and they want to get in front of your customers. And it was uncomfortable at first, because like, no, this is my account. Like, why are you coming into my business? But they wanted to see, did we have a supporter? I now learned a champion at that point mm-hmm. in time. You know, did you actually have differentiating criteria in your evaluations that would separate you from the competition? And I didn't know this at all, but I remember I was out with Scott Davis, and we went to CNA Insurance, Motorola, Baxter, and then some of the exchanges. Motorola just shows you that I am, in fact, 17 years ago. So you know, back when the flip phones were still out. But when we were going back and forth in those areas, it was like they were just asking me those questions. And Scott came back to me at the end. He said, "You're the most unconsciously competent person I have ever met." He's like, "You've never actually had formal sales training. Yet you know you need someone to sponsor your deal. You know you need to have a business justification because someone's got to pay for it. But you're not doing these things." He's like, "We are going to make you consciously competent." Mm. And, you know, your sponsor, what's in it for him or her? What's going to happen to their career if you're successful with this engagement? How do you build them up to really support that? How do you defend when it comes to the CFO and you get to the economic buyer? Like all those things, if you've never been trained and then all of a sudden you just get immersed in this stuff, everything just makes sense. And from that moment on, I went from serially just making my number to being 200, 300%. And then unfortunately, when you're really good, they promote you. So that happened. But there was another aspect of it in that time. So they also brought in Dolly Reich. And that's when I first met Dolly back in 2007. So the whirlwind began back in there. So hopefully that was a good explanation.
It's an incredible explanation. And it's always so nice to hear about it on the receiving end, right? And I don't necessarily want to fast forward to Wiz and where you are today now. But, you know, I think, you know, having had that experience, surely that's going to lend yourself well to, you know, the position that you're in now, in that, you know, you're coming into Wiz and obviously starting to take over there.
Yep.
So how are you competently thinking about that and that integration?
Well, there's a couple of things. And, you know, this is the fourth company that I've worked with Dolly on. It's the fourth company that I've worked with Mike on. You know, like I said, when the Blade Logic takeover happened, you know, Mike was my SDR and Dolly was my frontline leader.
Yeah.
So for anyone of you that know Dolly, imagine all that intensity being an individual rep with that. So it was a big learning curve for it. But we ran that exercise, and then you basically learn every job as you go along. So I had never led before. Dolly promoted me and I ran four states in the Midwest. And you learn a ton being a frontline leader. Any mistake that you could make, I definitely made it. But it's that whole aspect of it. But that experience set me up to go to AppDynamics. Mm-hmm. So when we joined AppDynamics, Dolly did something that I still think was one of the smartest moves you could make. He put people that had at least frontline experience in all the major geos across the US. You know, you had Spencer Tuttle, you had Jesse Green, you had Mark Solberg, you had Evan Blake, you had Brian Whitlin, you had, you know, Trevor Mallon was already on board. But all these people that are already in the organization, and when I started, I was in Minnesota. I had an SC and an inside salesperson and a stapler. And Dolly just said, go make it work. Go find it. Go build it. But some of the things that just you learn along the way as you go, and that learning sets you up for the next job. Mm. So when we went to the Zscaler, or Zscaler over here in the UK, that building aspect of it was great, because when we came into Zscaler, they were small and they were growing. They're about a $300 million company, and they needed to scale and go quickly. So that learning of building kind of goes along the way. So I think to answer your question about Wiz now, I've now that this is the fourth company we've done together, all those learnings of building teams in different stages of their company's career just makes you better for the next one. Mm. But you always have to find something that challenges you. You always have to get outside your comfort zone. And for me, that's going to be running broader aspects of EMEA, because I now know the UKI. We built a great team and a great culture. How do I build that great team and great culture across a broader geo, across different countries, different languages, different ways of doing business? It's going to be an exciting journey. And I'm beyond excited and thrilled and blessed to be doing that for the company.
Incredible. So how did you find yourself in the UK then, as a fellow American?
So I was laughing, and there's a couple of things that I will say, because I started in January of 2020. Didn't know the pandemic was coming, so I wouldn't recommend that to moving three. I've got three girls. They're now 18, 16, and 12. But when we moved over here, they were younger. So I basically took them out of a nice little comfortable nest in the Midwest. They cried, and then they came over here. And then if we ever have to go back, they will cry again, because they absolutely love it. But it's been just it's been such a great experience to go over. And I try to find stories and tell examples, because I think people remember those. But my oldest daughter had a dance recently, and she had seven friends come over, and they're from six different countries. Wow. So now you've got this different experience that will set them up for life. So you always have the professional aspirations, but you mix it with the personal aspirations. And so I always go back to Dolly. Dolly's known as this leader that is intense and everything, but he's also someone that always takes that personal aspect of it to say, I know that if Josh is going to be successful, I've got to balance his personal life with his professional life and find a way to collaborate that into it. So it's worked out quite well for us.
Because your introduction to the UK was in at Zscaler, right?
Correct.
Maybe you can just elaborate on the actual, you know, the move itself and how that came about.
So when we came over here, and again, back to the original statement that I made, you know, the things that the American said that is completely outside, and some I probably can't say, because in the U.S. we've got this analogy, belt and suspenders, and I found out really quick that that means something completely different.
It doesn't carry
over here, but it, you know, as an example of things that you learn quickly when people are all... but there's some other aspects of it that go in, and just maybe cultural aspects. I always joke, like, when I first started, I came over here and I was introduced as a whirlwind. It was a halftime for us. And then I came to the UK, and they did a really good job of putting in playbook leaders across the business. You know, Izzy was already over here. Mark Pete was here, and they were hiring a bunch of great people. So I came into the office. They had brought in a bunch of new people that were young, eager to learn. And I walk in and I just said, shouldn't we be calling people? Like, let's start. Like, let's go. Like, let's go sell some stuff. Like, right. let's get out there. And they're like, well, we don't. What do you mean? Like, who do we call? What's the messaging? Who are the personas? So we had all these bright, eager to learn people, but they didn't even know the basics of building a territory plan or a PG plan, or who are the personas we want to go talk to, and why would they want to talk to us, and what were the big rocks that we could go uncover for them. So I just rolled up my sleeves, and it was great. I had all these eager people like listening, like, well, here's how you build the territory. Here's how you rank your territory. Here's the people. Here's the messaging. Here's how we work with the ecosystem. And it was a brilliant aspect of it. So I'm feeling pretty proud about myself, of, you know, going, and I was commuting back. And then I come back, and I remember this story vividly as well, because it can't all be about building and developing. You also have to mix in the revenue aspect of it. And so I remember I came back, and I'm 3 weeks in the job now, and I sit down, and I was talking to Mark at the time. He's like, Mark said to me, he's like, how do you think it's going? I was like, oh, it's brilliant. Like, they're doing this, they're doing this. And he's like, you're doing things that will affect Q+1, Q+2. He's like, we need to hit Q3. So if we don't hit Q3, then we can't hit the revenue projections and the hiring criteria that we want to go do. So it was a great aspect for me to go learn. And back to your point on, as you learn and develop, these are the things that you have to realize as a leader. You have to balance the future with the present. Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? And how do you go find those other aspects of it? So some of those initial learnings were was a crazy aspect of it. The other thing about it was when I started, there was 2 leaders in place and there was 11 individual contributors. When I left, and it was about a 38 million ARR book of business in the UK. When I left, it was over $250 million book of business. We had 10 RDs, our frontline leaders. We had about 60 reps in place and 3 second-line leaders and a massive ecosystem supporting it. So that growth and the learnings that came with it, you know, structuring territories, building those things out, getting the ecosystem, the lift from the channel, all those aspects that come into it, I got to do that over here in the UKI and I got to build that out. Those learnings that I'm going to take here. So it's been a good four and a half years run.
Incredible.
You mentioned that at the beginning that you had a really, really good relationship with the US. And I think this is probably a good time to start talking about what were your kind of perceptions of the UK market prior to coming over? And perhaps what are you also now learning about the European market? Because that's a whole different, you know, that's a whole different beast in itself. So take us through that.
Well, there's a couple things. And I remember there was a comment made, and I'll leave off the person that made the comment, because they said, I think it's easier to sell in the US than it is over here. And I kind of dismissed the comment when it came up because I didn't want to acknowledge it. Like, selling is selling, pain is pain, a problem is a problem. If you can go to a company, give them a return on investment, solve a major aspect of it, it doesn't matter where you're selling in the world, that's what it is. But I will say it is a little bit harder to sell, at least in the UK and the Middle East and some of the other aspects of it, because there's a lot less transient kind of cultures. Like in the US, a lot more people come in. They're much more willing to try things earlier. It just seems that aspect of driving that aspect, you have to be cleaner and crisper on the way that we run our business, maybe more so than it would be in the US. But the world is now, there isn't any geos anymore. And some of the things that people realize is, if you're a G2K account, you're in Europe, you're in the US, you're in, you know, Asia Pac, you're in India, you're everywhere. So you can't take just a European view or a US view. You have to take a corporate worldwide view, because Wiz already has 40% of the Fortune 100. Like, they're solving those. So that means we're already a global company addressing major global problems. So I don't think of it necessarily as US versus Europe anymore. What I do think about it is collaboration. How are we talking to one another? How are we collaborating? How are we enabling that aspect of it, so then we can actually get the scales that we want to go do? Because at the end of the day, while that comment, maybe it is easier in the US, funding's a little bit richer maybe, I don't think it really matters on a global scale as much as some people would think.
Is there a cultural difference in terms of, from a sales perspective, what you've seen from UK sellers and the US sellers, or is it quite similar?
There definitely is a cultural difference. And I would say, just stereotypically speaking, it is much more relationship focused in the US. And over here, it's definitely more, you got to earn the right. Like, that's why the process, I think, really works over here. Because if you're not detailing out business case justification, if you're not proving those capabilities out, it is a more structured, more methodological approach to how they go through things. And the relationship aspect in the US, I think people move around a little bit more freely, and there's maybe a little less that needs to be done in terms of criteria and qualification. So I would think that would probably be the biggest thing that I would say, a little bit more cautious, a little bit more methodical, and the US maybe a little bit more relationship or willing to take a bit of a risk more so than it would be over here.
You spoke about, and I just want to take it back a step, you spoke about collaboration and you spoke about the process of that. What is that process, and how do you ensure that there's a collaborative environment and in within the US and the European market?
Well, first of all, you don't have to overthink it. Mm. So the biggest thing about everything is well, there's a couple of things that I do that I socialize with not only my team here, but everyone that I work with, is we're just transparent.
Okay.
Where are we going? Where are we working? Who's doing the job? Where's it going? So if you're not having constant communication, and I'll go back to my conversation with Mike and I, when we were running the biggest accounts that we were trying to close, we just talked. What is your team doing? Where do you need some help? What are the pain statements? Because if you take a look at any organization, you're going to have executives everywhere. So the more you can be collaborative, the more you can just be open and transparent, then it just enables that good-willed natureness. Now, I think you have to have that underlying aspect of trust. Hmm. And I kind of go back to, I'm never going to do something short-term to ruin a relationship long-term. This is the fourth company we're going to be at, and we want to be here for a very long time. But if, you know, once this goes public and once we do a bunch of other things, then the next company may come along or the next journey may happen. So I'm not going to ever burn that bridge. It's not worth it in the short term to go do something like that. So it's almost breaking this fiefdom of this is my account or this is my thing. I'm not going to let anyone else come in to help win it. But if you change that around and say, we're going to go win a G2K account. They are massive if we can go get across some of these benefit areas that we can go do. And the only way you can do that is if you're constantly communicating with one another. Mm-hmm. So don't overthink it. Have a business plan. Go after an account and work it together and be collaborative to it. And then that aspect of it. Now, what typically happens, to your point, and this happened at Zscaler, where if you didn't have that communication, then emails start to go through across or they've got a big presence over here and we deserve X percent of this.
Right.
Well, why? Like, have you worked it or not? And it starts out on the bad foot. But if you're going in on the right foot and you're collaborative, you've got a good plan for your business. You've got a good plan for your territory, what you want to go take. You're collaborating across the pond and across the globe, really, about who we want to go see, who we want to go meet. It flows and it's really easy. Like, there was one time where they brought us on and they said, what do you guys do that make it work? And Mike and I looked at each other and we're like, we don't really do anything. Mm-hmm. Like, we just talk. Mm-hmm. Like, we're just open with the work that we're doing. We just share information. So I think people are always trying to find that secret sauce. And really, the most of it is just goes down to trust and open communication.
So do you see it as one cell rather than two different cells as a such? So it's a business rather than it's the U.S., it's Europe, it's APAC.
Yeah, we're Wiz.
We're Wiz, yeah.
Yeah, if we don't work, then Wiz fails. And more importantly, our customers fail. So if you take a look at whatever platform you're trying to sell, or whatever product or service you're trying to represent, typically speaking, most people don't get the full value out of it because I'll take a step back. I hate leads. And I always use this because it's kind of a shock and awe statement. Like, what do you mean I hate leads? And from what I've seen so far, the Wiz marketing team and the brand that they built and the number of inbound stuff, it's unbelievable. Now, the problem with leads, though, is when someone reaches out to you, they've already fundamentally made up their mind of what problem that they have and how they think you can solve it. And all they're really looking for you to do is just to validate it. Show me the tech, show me this, just to make sure that my aspects are correct. But if you take the Wiz platform, for example, cloud configuration and misconfigurations, that's kind of the core of what everyone knows that we do. But we can also benefit how companies release applications and how they do that more quickly. 40% of a developer's time is not spent developing. It's spent doing all the other aspects of what they're going to go do. So if we can help that aspect, if we can help an organization release an application a couple months faster, you know, we're talking 8 figures, 9 figures benefit to the organization. But if you just respond to a lead and so someone that you just do that one aspect that they thought, you're not doing it. So going back to your aspect on global collaboration, like, once a lead comes in, I don't need people to respond to those. I don't want people to respond to those. Mike doesn't. We don't. We want to take a step back. Look, that's an indication that there's a pain point. Now come back and actually run the process. Do the discovery. Do some research so you earn the right. Why would this company be reaching out to us? What can we go do? And then how do we get wider so it gets absorbed and adopted by the whole organization? But more importantly, they get a lot more value from it. Because if we're just looking at misconfigurations, that's one thing. But if we're releasing applications faster, if we're getting plugged into their SOC and they're triaging and troubleshooting attacks faster, like, that's so much more benefit and value to an organization, yet it's still the same product. So the company feels better about it. We've done a better job doing it. We're probably getting a better price point for it because we've proven the value of our platform. So when it comes to the aspect of collaboration and what we do, the biggest thing that we do is, like, don't answer the phone and don't go run to give a demo. Do your job. Your job is to be a consultant to the company that you're representing to make sure they get the most value out of it. And that's why we hire and we pay great people.
How have you adapted over the last few years working in this geo? Or is it just natural progression as a leader as you learn more about being a great leader?
So I think it's a mix of both. And yeah, I'd be naive to say that if I came in here and I didn't think that different cultures had different, you know, you learn in nuances of the environment. Oh yeah, I learned a crash course in some of the things that I came in and what we do. And, you know, I always make jokes from time to time, like, giddy up, let's go. You know, you kind of make fun of the American stereotypes and some of the things. Yeah. But then you always go back and you just make sure you reground people that, you know, good people are good people and we're educating. So as I go into new countries and as I learn more about Europe and lean on the leaders and the people that we have there, like understanding that is learning first. Like, how do you go into a new, you know, new company, new culture, and new geo and really learn about the nuances of that environment? But you do so with, you treat people with respect. That goes across all cultures. You listen, you care, you learn. That translates to any language, any company, any culture.
The onward journey now is for you to take a bigger scope, right? So far you've been running UK, Middle East, and Africa.
Yep.
And now it's EMEA-wide.
It's EMEA-wide.
What's the process you're going through now? Have you had much exposure to those markets, even from afar? And what are you going through right now in really kind of taming that?
So you're always going to have a little bit of cross-pollination across EMEA. All the big banks have a presence in London, but they may be based in Central Europe, or the other aspects are across the board. So you're always going to have a little bit of collaboration and working with the other teams. I always use the competition as a kind of a motivator as we collaborate. But we had a rule at Zscaler, which I think is right. Like, you don't split in geos, you work in geos. We are one EMEA, we are one team. And that's definitely one thing I'm bringing over here. Like, we have to be a cohesive unit of how we share and collaborate and have information. But as it comes to the broader scale and scope of it, yeah, there's going to be a lot of learning that I need to go figure out. And I'm going to lean on the leaders that we have here to make it great. We've hired some already that are in place. They're all good playbook people so far, and they're great operators. But to answer your question to the next aspect of it, it's one thing to have great operators, but I think the reason why the UK and I was very successful in 3 of the 4 years that we're here, we were top in EMEA as the main geo, is because we had this North Star. We had this vision that we created where it aligned everybody in the business. So the North Star for the UKI last year was we wanted to have 3 million delighted users on the Zscaler platform. And the reason why we selected that is Zscaler in the UK had roughly 7 million users on the platform, but only 1.8 million of them were using more than one product. So they weren't really sticky. They had bought out of necessity in the pandemic. So by sitting down with all my leadership team from marketing and engineering and the technical architects and the CISO advisors, it was a massive ecosystem of people that were there. We said, how do we get everybody in the same boat together? And how do we make sure that those handoffs are happening? So kind of back to the communication that I was talking to you about with Mike, it also exists in every single area. So one of the things that Zscaler does really well is they hire a bunch of people to provide benefit. But one of the areas that I found needed to be optimized was how do they all work together? And so I'll use an example. I remember when I sat down with Trevlin, who ran marketing for me, and I said, when a lead comes in, where are we not catching it? How are we not optimizing that? Where is that going? And we just sit and we just identify all the processes that were in place. And then each week we would sit down and we try to optimize them. So we just make marginal gains and marginal improvements. But if I ever talked to anybody about my business, they knew I was talking to them about the North Star. We need to have 3 million delighted customers. Because if we have delighted customers, that means everyone participated. Customer success, engineering, architects, marketing. Like, we all won as a team. So when the WinWire came out, the team won. It wasn't the sales individual won or that person. So creating that collaborative culture of trust, communication, and just understanding how everyone works together, and then just knowing that I'm not going to get it right, but we're going to figure it out and we're going to tweak it as we go along. So you start with the plan, and then you optimize and you fine tune it as you go along. That, I think, separated the UK and I from a lot of other regions in geo, because the culture that it created there was something special.
You spoke about when we were speaking just offline with regards to the talent and that you're bringing in at the moment, and lots of that talent are taking a step back.
Yeah.
Right. Taking on less of a role. Help us understand what the strategy is there and what the vision is there and why people are doing that.
So there's a couple aspects, and I talked about one because, you know, when I left BMC and then we went to AppDynamics, you know, I was a frontline leader. And I was running, four states in the central part of the U.S. And then Dali says, here's an inside sales guy, here's an engineer, and here's a stapler. Go make it work. Go figure it out.
That stapler's following you around,
Josh. Stapler's following
around.
Still
got the stapler.
But it's the joke that we always say, like, look, go build it. Like, here, yeah. Like, you're just going to go figure stuff out as you go along. And, like, if I didn't have the frontline leadership experience, I would have thought about how I approach growth differently. So one of the things that I'm absolutely obsessed with is getting the most out of every single resource that works with me and benefits from it. And so I knew running four states in the Midwest, I couldn't scale. So I made a big bet with the with our partners in the channel. And I just, in the major cities of the geo, I just sat down and I picked a partner, you know, whether it was a head in Minneapolis. And I just said, every deal I find, I'm going to run through you. And I'm going to earn the right at some point that you're going to start bringing me deals. And then you're going to go to every meeting with me. So I just had this very collaborative approach because I knew I could only make so many calls. I knew I could only be in so many meetings. But if I found a way to scale myself, then we could do it. So that learning about running a business as a frontline leader, that's the first time you stop thinking about yourself and you start thinking of the broader aspect of the people that are there. Taking that learning and using that one simple example of, I can't do this on my own. I need to scale with other people. I think that's a pretty good example of, that's one learning that I immediately apply to the next role. Now, coming here, it's going to be the same thing. We're taking a team that is very small in EMEA. EMEA is roughly 15% of the total revenue of Wiz. Wow. So that's going to change very quickly. And we're going to be building and we're going to be growing. So how we build that out and what we did, and I'll use the Zscaler example. When I came in, two frontline leaders, 11 individual contributors. Then we grew that to the, you know, 10 frontline leaders and 60 reps and three second line leaders. To do that, it takes transparency. It takes accountability. It takes all the things that go with it. Because right now, all the accounts, there's 2,000 accounts in the UK as an example. There's 11 people in the UK at Wiz. Mm. So how are we going to build this thing to be 10 frontline leaders, you know, 60 reps? And how do we build those territories out? So the learnings that I went through there, because we didn't get it right every time, but we pivoted, we changed, we tweaked it. That learning will save, I'll just learn from that as I go build this thing out across the board. And now I have to do that at an EMEA level. So now I need to lean on the leaders in those different geos to go build it out together. But I can go back to those proof points. Well, here's where I stumbled. Here's where I made a mistake, or here's where I pivoted, and here's where I upset the customers because I moved accounts too fast. We don't get it right as people and leaders. Mm-hmm. We learn and grow. But if we're open and honest with people and they believe, because I do, have their best interests at heart, then they'll believe and follow and we'll make the corrections and the changes as we go. And I think that's that speaks for itself.
Yeah, because you're learning by taking that one step back to get closer to what you're managing.
Yeah.
Right. And so as an individual, if you're a first line leader and you're going into an individual, if you're a first line leader, you need to get back into that IC seat to really understand, okay, what is it? What were the problems that we're solving for a customer? I think, you know, Carlos and I, we were talking last week that, you know, the playbook is a great framework, but at the same time, it can be applied and it gives you an ability to be able to start mapping things out. But without, you know, but you've got to understand that every organization is different, right? Yeah. And so you've got to be able to go back and apply that, whereas obviously some leaders can get it wrong through just thinking it's a cookie cutter. I'm going to go and do exactly what I did at Zscaler. I'm going to do exactly the same thing. I'm now at Wiz.
You raise a really good point. And so just yesterday I had a call with someone that's a frontline leader that I'm asking to come in as an individual contributor. And the talk track went something along this line. I said, you've been a frontline leader for 2 years now. You're probably thinking that your next job is going to be a second line leader. I said, but you're not going to be on a rocket ship. Like this technology here, you just need to get on the bus. You need to get in the door and we need to go build this thing. And he was very concerned about this impact. I said, well, let's think about this. Here's what we did at Zscaler and here's how fast we grew. If I bring you in and I give you, you know, 50 enterprise accounts and you learn our technology, you learn the customers, you learn the pain points, the personas, the problems, and you build the book of business and you get promoted, that same geo, that same patch that you just built is your patch. That's now you're leading that patch and you're scaling that patch out. So everything you do is there. Plus, you've already got frontline experience. So you're already thinking like that example I used there before. You're thinking bigger than a typical individual contributor does because you know it's the longer game. You know it's the bigger aspect of it. So how you build your territory is going to be much different. So those are the learnings. At the end of the call, he was like, I'm in. Let's go. Yeah. Because he knows that in 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, we're going to be doubling the size of this thing because Wiz went from nothing in 4 years.
350 million.
In ARR, fastest growing startup. We are sitting on an unbelievable platform that solves really, really big problems and customers love it. And they love it because it does what it's supposed to.
What are your primary objectives right now? What are you focusing on? What's kind of phase one, phase two? And then what are some of the things that perhaps you're going to start looking at as things start to, as the foundations are laid?
So first and foremost, and I used an example earlier on where you got to do both. You got to hit the number and you got to build out the right culture and grow. So the first thing that is really important to me is just building trust. You know, I've already had an all hands call, third day on the job. I just told the story similar to what I'm telling now. I don't know how to run a meal, but we're going to figure it out together. And that transparency, that vulnerability, I think everyone needs to have, because we're going to make mistakes along the way, and that's okay. But if your heart's in it and you're leaning in, then we're going to get there through this together. So there has to be that aspect of trust. Then we have to get the necessary systems in place, the necessary aspects so we can help create, you know, grow and train and develop people. Because right now we just don't have the necessary tools in place to give coaching that we want to give on a coaching basis. So back to yourself, one of the things that I've got three things that I really, really care about, and I've alluded to them, but I'll be clear on what they are now. The first thing is, and we did this at Zscaler, where all of my second line leaders each week broadcast the entire ecosystem in the UKI. Here are the key meetings that were booked. Here's the new VO that was created. Here's what we're doing as a sales team, because in sales, you own the number, but everyone in the organization gets paid off of what we do collaboratively. So when I go talk about that North Star of winning together, like when I publish those numbers and my leaders publish those numbers, I'm not doing it to just show what activity people are doing it. I'm doing it because I want people to lean in. Mm. But that accountability also comes too. When you come into my organization and you come into Wiz organization, the expectations of what we expect from you are very clear. I don't try to tell you, I'm not hiring you to be a lawyer. I'm not hiring you to be anyone else. I'm hiring you to be a sales professional. And as a sales professional, the expectations are you're going to have this level of activity. You're going to drive this level of VO. You're going to be running the book of business, because that's what we need to grow this thing to where it needs to be. But that's the trust aspect of it. Now, the second key thing that I'm extremely passionate about is personal development. So if you're in my organization, each week you have to have a 1-hour session with your leader that is not about the forecast, not about this, but are you getting better week over week? Now, you can't do that if you don't have a plan. So a lot of people will come in, and I'm a big believer there's two types of people in this world, one that have a plan and one that don't. And then the people that don't, they don't belong here, because I want people to get better, and you can't get better if you're not measuring the things you're doing week over week. And you can't get better if you're not working with your partner, with your leader. So the whole aspect behind it is no one has ever left a leader that has made them better 52 times a year. If every time they sit down, they have the best interest at heart and how they go do that. Now, what I coach is if you're an individual contributor and you're not ready for that meeting, then your leader needs to fix that. But if you're an individual contributor and you're ready and you want to get better and your leader's not prepared, they haven't looked at the data, they haven't seen the gaps ahead, they're not spending the time, then that's my problem and I'll go fix that. But that trust, that collaboration, that week over week, it enables a lot of little conversations. So if week two comes and you didn't make a pivot, like, you know, you were off last week. You didn't seem to hit your numbers, everything all right? Like, what's going on? Yeah, and the reason, the context will come in. But if the next week comes in and they still haven't done it, then you can have a little conversation like, what's going on? Is this not the right fit? But if you wait 13 weeks or do it in a QBR, you've wasted a whole quarter. You've wasted that revenue. Now it's a big conversation. Now it's just awkward and everyone's uncomfortable. So have a bunch of little conversations. And if you do that and you're disciplined enough to do that week over week, man, you change people's lives and it's great.
Mm. I can't remember who we're talking about with that, which was...
Believe in PIP.
You don't believe in PIP. Was that us on Sunday?
That was on Sunday, about? Yeah.
Because if you get to a PIP...
It's too late.
Why would you ever get to a PIP?
Yeah.
In the scenario I just ran you through, you never get to a PIP because you quickly figure out the things that aren't working. And then if you don't want to change them, well, then it's just not a good fit. And that's okay. Because, and I remember Scott Davis told me this one time, like, if it's not right, it's not right. So let them go do something that they're really good at, because you're not helping anyone in an organization that's not right for them. So be very transparent in the interview process about what the job is, what the role is, and why we are looking to go grow this thing. So everyone comes in with a common expectation of what's expected. Then you sit down, you have that discipline to go through week over week in that development. Little conversations. There is no PIPs because they don't need to exist because you've already worked that out. So hopefully you get pretty good at doing that so you don't have to have a lot of little conversations and everyone comes in with the roles. But those are the the key aspects of why it's important.
What's the hiring profile?
So first and foremost, and again, we're a playbook company, so I'll use some terms and I'll explain them as I go along because I think a lot of people need to know. So we hire in what we call ICE-based criteria. So I is intelligence, C is character, there's another C for coachability, and then E is experience. I bucket them into two categories. If your mom and dad didn't make you a good person and they didn't give you enough marbles in your head, I can't affect that. Now, I'm going to ask you a lot of questions during the process to gauge if you're intelligent, to see if you're a good person. And so from a hiring profile, that's one aspect of it, but I can't change it. Now, experience is also something that it is what it is. So I want people that have had a track record of success. I want people that don't jump from job to job. So as my example, I've worked now in our fourth company over 17 years. I had a 13-year run at BMC. I had a 6-year run at Depth Dynamics and had just a 4.5-year run at Zscaler. And hope this whiz one, hopefully it's my last one, but wherever it goes.
You're too young for that.
Yeah, but the point goes in, like if you see a bunch of people that are hopping from job to job or one thing, that doesn't interest me. I want people to come in and learn because you really don't impact someone's business until year two. If you're excellent in year one and then you're bad in year two, that just means you closed whatever someone else closed. So when I look at a CV or I look at someone's profile, I'm looking to see, have they stuck around? Have they made smart career progressions throughout their career? Did they go from an inside sales to an enterprise sales to a major account sales to a frontline lead? I'd look at their progression. Does that look right? Does that look like intelligent decisions through the process? And if there's gaps in that, then I'll ask those questions in the process. So to be clear on that, the experience one, I want to see them stick around for a while. I want to see them have a consistent track record of being successful over at least a 3-year period of time. And I want them to have logical promotions and paths. Now, the final one for me and where I spend about 80% of my time is on coachability. So we've already talked about how important development is to me because I believe if you can make someone great, you've changed their life. If you can make them and absorb what we do, you've changed their life. But if they come in thinking that they already know everything, I already know this. I know this CISO. I know this guy. I know this guy. I don't want you. I want people to come in and they want to learn. I'm very open and vulnerable at the open challenges. I'm scared to go figure out how to run EMEA. I'm going to go do it. We're going to go figure it out. And I have great coaches and leaders to go help me through that process. So if you ever stop learning, if you ever stop thinking you're not coachable, if I get that feeling during the interview based on how you've answered questions, that's probably the most important one for me. Again, mom and dad, did they do their job? And then experience is what it is. You probably won't get to me if the experience isn't there because we're going to screen you out ahead of time. So we spend 80% of that time on, do you really want to be great? Do you really want to learn? Do you really want to develop? Because that's where we change people's lives.
So Josh, obviously within the community, within the network, we know that, you know, the community does talk and everyone does have a reputation or within the back channel. And I think just to give you some of the feedback that we've heard about you from the back channel is that, you know, you are someone that really is a great recruiter. But what are the other aspects that you think that have really helped you to reach the heights that you have in your career?
It's a good question. I wish I could give you the answer that I've intentionally did this. But you know, we've talked about family being really important, and you know, when you're in a career, I always put that first and foremost. And so I always told Dolly, like, look, I need to have a career that I can manage and be home, try to block off Mondays and Fridays so I have those long weekends. There's always exceptions to that travel, but one of the things that kind of limited me to was, you know, that second line leadership role. And it's a funny thing when you stop trying to get promoted, you stop trying to think of yourself and know that you're just in the role to make people great. Like it's just, you change people's life. And I always joke and say this. So we believe in you recruit great people, you retain great people like we talked about and how we do that. And then obviously revenue is a key aspect of it. And I always joke and I say, I've never had to worry about revenue because if you hire great people and you train and develop them, then revenue just seems to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's not that easy, obviously, but that whole focus of just me focusing on how do I make someone great? How do I get them better in their job? And that was my sole focus to it. It just kind of happened because I didn't want to get promoted. I stopped trying to get promoted. And it just, that was the byproduct of it. once I realized that, once I became consciously competent, that holy crap, this is changing people's lives, then it changed the game. The other aspect, and one of the key things that I think I did better than most, and definitely, so in the last year in the UK and I, we were voted best place to work and also the best place for women. And one of the things that Ben, who was a recruiter that I work with, Ben Fairhill, thank you very much. He forced everyone in my team to look at an equal amount of diverse candidates across the board. So I was lucky enough that two of my three second line leaders were females, and females attract other great females. And when you have a diverse team and a diverse candidate, you just become unstoppable because of the force and the things that go along with it. Because you're constantly being challenged, you're constantly learning new things. So I think when you, again, it kind of goes back to, if you didn't have a plan, if I didn't have something that I knew was identified, then I put it in my plan saying, okay, the plan is I need to make sure that I have an equal number of candidates coming in that I'm looking at. Because if you don't have a plan, you're recruiting and you just get the CVs that are coming in, guess what? 90% of them are going to be white males, and and you're not going to build a diverse team because you're just not, there's not enough volume. But if your plan is I need to look at an equal amount of CVs that are going to be there, then you get them in the process. Then by a byproduct that you get a very diverse team. Now, when they come in the meeting, in the interview with me, I generally close them the same way because I take great pride in the team that we built. And I always say, like, I want to make you great. And you can't say that to somebody if you don't believe it. And so when you say that and you make that personal connection to them and you know the real why of why they got there, then that bond stays with you for life. And then it's that carry on with it, that week over week insistence that my leaders are doing everything that they can to make that person great along the way. So it's that trust that gets established from the day one in the interview process.
So what's the plan for the next 12, 18, 36 months at Wiz?
Well, we're growing. We've already ran through some of the numbers of, you know, the fastest, to 380 million, fastest to 100 million. In the next 12 to 18 months, you know, right now we have three frontline sales teams in the UK, three in Central. We've got two in France, two in the Nordics and Benelux area. And then we got an emerging market team. We'll be double the size in the next 12 to 18 months. So we are hiring great people. You know, back to your point, we need great people. It's a startup. Mm-hmm. So back to the whole stapler comment, like when you come in, you just have to go do whatever the job is to go make sure that it works. So when people want to come in and say, well, what's my job? What's my role? And they kind of want to be put in a box. I don't need that. I need people that are going to constantly think, what else can I go do? How do we make this great? What can we go build? And we're going to build this thing together. And it's a lot easier to build when people have that open mindset. When people have, I'm going to take a quote unquote step back in my career to come in and build things the right way and learn how to go do this. Because those learnings will serve you well for the rest of your life and your career. Just like we ran through some of the examples there. Never shortcut any sort of journey that you want to be on. But get in with the people that know that are going to be investing in your future, that care about you. And the best way to say it is the founders of Wiz have been together since 2001. Dolly, Mike, and I have been together since 2007. The team that is now the broader ecosystem, David Goodmark, who's running the US, this is the third job together. And I could go on and listen to this. This crew, this team of trusting people will stay together forever. And the reason why we're staying together is we're continually building out great people and diverse candidates are coming across the board so that this team is now the biggest, best trusted team in the planet. And now you combine that with great technology, a massive addressable market, cloud, SecOps, AI. Like Wiz has three markets that are 50 billion in TAM each that they could go after.
Wow.
And it's going to be an unbelievable growth journey for us.
It's a great story. It's a great journey. And congratulations, obviously. It is a recent appointment at the point of recording. And we're really excited to see how things do transpire for you. I think this is a really good time for us to kind of reflect on some of the things that we've spoken about, because at the top of the podcast, we were talking about, you know, the American in the UK finding himself in the European market and some of those learnings. And I think what I've taken from this and the biggest reflection is that, yes, there can be a disconnect between different regions, but that's on a human level. Mm-hmm. And I think that if on a human level you do make the effort to really understand and really collaborate, that will actually transcend any geo. That will transcend any environment, any culture. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why you've been able to build such world-class teams, and the reason why you have been trusted, because where you are is earned. You know, this isn't a boys' club. This is an environment on meritocracy where you've been able to bring the best out. And I think your maniacal obsession in developing and enabling and creating an environment where people can genuinely come and be the best version of themselves, I think that's what's created the vacuum for you to continue to grow. And that's why more and more opportunity has been earned.
Yeah.
And that's where we are today. And I think that it's that desire to really understand what's happening with your people and really being there for them, which then creates the opportunity for yourself. So I think it's been great spending the time. It's been great to get to know you and really looking forward to seeing how your journey unfolds over the next few years.
I look forward to it as well and appreciate the time. Great.
It's been absolutely fantastic. So to all our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in today. If you've liked what you heard, please do subscribe to our various channels on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube and LinkedIn. All the links are in the description below, but we look forward to welcoming you back for another session very soon. Take care and goodbye.